You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriting. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer. For more information about this podcast, please see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. My guest for episode 46 is Chandler Travis, a fixture of the New England music scene. He started out in a comedy duo with Steve Shook, and his first release is 1974's Travis Shook and the Club Wow. In the 80s, he started a band called the Incredible Casuals. You're listening right now to Long As You Have Somebody Else from their first album, That's That. His first solo album came in 1992, and by 1999, he had put together the Chandler Travis Philharmonic, a nine-piece band with horns, and as you'd expect, a lot of big band influence. He is right now gigging constantly, alternating between the Philharmonic, the Chandler Travis 3-0, which is a smaller version of the Philharmonic, the Casuals still play, and 2011 marked the first release of the Catbirds, a rock four-piece that he co-fronts. Today we're going to talk about the song The Strong Man of North America, released on the Philharmonic's Waving Kissy Head Volume 2 and 1, 2017. We'll then turn to the Catbirds with the song The Crutch of Music from the 2012 album Catbirds Say Yeah, then look back slightly to Fluffy from the Philharmonic album Llama Rhymes from 2003. We'll conclude with another song from the current album called By the Way, although that was previously released on a compilation called Bocce and Bourbon from 2015. For more information on Chandler's doings, please see ChandlerTravis.com. Hello, Chandler. This is Mark.
We're rocking.
All right. So I was at a little bit of a loss as to what to play for the opening music. You saw we went back and forth a little bit. Typically, either try to catch the thing that the person is best known for, the big single that they don't necessarily want to have to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
There are many possible things that could fall into that category. The other option is just something early, but does that mean something off your first solo album or something from the 70s in your one 1974 album, which I just heard some of last evening?
Oh, the Travis and Shook one?
Yeah, which interesting, you know, that you even had some horns and things. Yeah, it was a pretty lavish arrangements for...
I forgot about it. I hadn't really thought about it in those terms that, yeah, we did have some horns way back then, didn't we? Just on a couple of things.
Right, right. But the thing you spent the most time with, at least it appears, that it's still going today, the Incredible Casuals. So I know that the 87 was not the first... That was the first full album, right? You had some singles and things before that.
Well, we had a maxi EP.
Okay.
But yeah. Yeah, in 87, I don't know how it ended up being that late. I'm still a little dubious about that date for some reason. I mean, part of it was that it came out in England before it came out in America, too. So I don't really remember the chronology all that well. That was back when we were doing things that made things easy to forget. I still pride myself on my forgetting capabilities, by the way. I don't dwell. I'm not that kind of guy.
Well, the whole reason in bringing it up is to talk about the evolution from that band, which it seemed like you were trying to do the... Everybody wants to be in the Beatles kind of thing. Not yeah. that it sounds terrific, like, but you know, it's a rock band, multiple singers, great harmonies.
Yeah. For us, it was maybe more the Kinks a little bit because you got to adjust your expectations a little bit to your abilities. And also the Kinks were just, it's hard to beat the Kinks.
Yes. Johnny sounds a heck of a lot like Graham Parker to me. You gotten that comparison?
He doesn't mean to.
Well, it's not a bad thing. That's a nice presence. But in terms of the evolution of your style, was there something, and I know that band still exists in some form, at least you were gigging as late as 2013, is that right?
Yes, we haven't played gigs for the last 3 years, I think, something like that.
So just say a little about how you steer the material to the different bands. So you've got that thing, which was, you know, your core in the 80s, at least, was your core musical project. But then you're doing, by the 90s, you're doing solo albums. You now have the 3-0, the small band, and then the Philharmonic that you have to pay more people. And also the Catbirds. Is that to kind of fill the rock and roll hole that the Incredible Casuals were filling before? Or how are these different...
The rock and roll hole is very important to fill with me. You know, you were saying about writing songs for various bands, and I wish I was as disciplined as that idea. Pretty much I write what I write, and then if I happen to have a band that can play one of the songs, then it goes somewhere. I wish I was better at putting things together to order a little bit. I mean, I can do it if somebody gives me a specific project, but sadly, as far as giving myself projects, I'm not that disciplined.
Now, having the Philharmonic at your disposal, that you've taken some of the older songs and put them through the ringer, that you can now do crazy things with the arrangement that were not possible to do before.
True, yeah.
And I guess so the first song we're going to play in full, The Strong Man of North America from the most recent album.
Oh, good. I'm glad you're playing
Waving
that.
Kissy Head Volume 2. And the fact that you've got horns, it doesn't sound like Unlike, I guess, some of the others on the album that sound more like their approach from a, we have a 9-piece band, let me arrange something for that. This sounds like a very highly disciplined studio recording. The horns stay out of it for quite a while. And then when they do come in, it's just such a surprise. It's such a nice contrast. It serves its role. So it sounds like George Martin is arranging this stuff, not that you just have all these people that are sitting around being bored and waiting to come in.
Well, that's very much a studio creation. I mean, we had a whole arrangement that we liked and that we thought was done. And then we went into the studio and all kinds of things happened, which is how it's supposed to work, which is, I mean, you know, that's when things really start to be fun. One thing that happened was my friend Steve Berkowitz, who's been my buddy for years and helped place us with the Casuals, with Rounder and with Demon overseas. He came up with the idea of having almost everything drop out on the chorus, which is basically right where I had everything coming in. The idea was so much opposite to what I had been thinking, and I have always have such respect for Steve, that I don't know, it just tickled me to try something that was as alien to me as that was when he first suggested it. So that made the whole thing go in all these different directions. We had a ball with that one.
Well, let's play and talk more about the composition.
Dropped by pathways, found them every time. Down a long tile hallway, little hand drops free. Barefoot as the waves, I chased back out to sea. Well, I'm not the man I was, here I am because I once was a strong man of North America. Stars fade, one by one they fell. Why I'm not the man I was, here I am because I once was the strong man of North America. When you thought the chimney might be falling, so frightened, that's when I stepped up into my calling, the strong man. When you let the world of love embrace you completely, then was time to set aside my costume. You made me the strong man. We retired the strong.
Drove with both hands on the steering wheel. cigar man. I would like a glass of water, please. Thank you. Barely like a strong man, I am weak. You made me a strong.
All right. So first off, I know this is one of three that we're going to play here out of our four that David Greenberger wrote the lyrics,
yeah.
Which I was just looking at his site and his project where he takes notes on what old people are saying, you know, some of them not completely compos mentis, and puts those out as kind of an art project.
Called the Duplex Planet, which is an amazing, amazing thing.
Okay.
The Duplex Planet is wonderful.
Yes.
So I want to give that a good plug. And a lot of David's lyrics have to do with aging as a result of his sideline mm-hmm. there. But he's starting to develop a little sidebar of songs about his daughter, Nora Bell. And Strongman of North America is on that list.
Really? Okay.
It's about raising a daughter.
It's pretty rare to find sort of an outside of the band lyricist, a friend of yours, to have this sort of long-term relationship with, especially when you're an accomplished lyricist already yourself. And yet I know, you know, I see on the credits, at least it says him lyrics, you music, as opposed to he writes lyrics and then you tweak them. So 20% of it changes to fit into the music. How does this relationship work, or how did this start?
That's pretty much what, you know, what you said is about right. I write the music and then, you know, it started off with him sending me lyrics. We did that for years. And then the last 10 years or so, we've done a lot more of me sending him tunes, which has been delightful for me because I think it's great for both of us. You come up with less linear things, sort of. You know, you don't have the four even lines per stanza as much.
Yeah.
So that's been fun, and he's been wonderful to work with in that way. He basically does end up doing, as you say, about 80% of the lyrics, and what I do is mostly just trying to shoehorn things in rhythmically, although there is some back and forth, but that's roughly it.
Yeah, I know a couple times when I've, you know, I take somebody's poem, a friend of mine's, I remember doing this and setting it to something, but I had to change a couple lines, just to like add some more rhymes in it. And that just sort of ruined it for her. Like that it was sacrilege. But I guess having a pre-established long-term relationship where there's a shared common goal is quite different than just setting.
It's an interesting thing. I mean, David's been terrific to work with. We have had a couple of times where he came up with a lyric that I didn't think was right for the tune. And our solution to that was to write another tune for that lyric and to write another lyric for the other tune. I thought that was a wonderful way of dealing with it. We sort of got the 2-for-1 thing going there. The other thing I wanted to comment on, because you mentioned that, you know, I do write a lot of my own lyrics. You can usually tell when it's a David lyric because his imagery is so much more advanced than mine is. My songs are very conversational and they're fine. But if you want imagery, you got to get David. I suck at imagery. What can I tell you?
Do you ever, you know, have a finished lyric of yours? And since you have this person to draw on, just send it his way and like, can you punch it up like a sitcom? You know,
he doesn't really like doing that. He likes starting from scratch.
Sure. It's a different craft. Well, so I would have thought that this sort of nonlinear thing that you're talking about and being able to develop the lyrics would help explain why there's talk singing in parts of this song. But then I saw you do a 2013 solo version of this on YouTube, and none of that was in there. It was all just straight singing. So is this just something that evolves as you're playing it live or in the studio?
It was all studio stuff. You know, I had an arrangement in mind that we played live for a year or so before we recorded it. And, you know, like I said, I thought we were done. Turns out we weren't at all. And that's one of the great things about playing with the Philharmonic is that when you get into the studio, it's as often a place to take things out rather than to add things because there's so much going on, you know, with nine pieces. Having a nine-piece band taught me about stillness and about pauses and about how important silence is. And I'm still learning about that and having, you know, there's no easier way to learn about that than to have nine guys dying to play. So it's fun getting in the studio and taking shit out. Editing. I love it.
All right. So when I hear bongos are coming in for a little bit here, there's probably a bongo track running through the whole thing that's only faded in 20% of the time. Is that correct?
If you're talking about Strongman, no.
Yes.
Strongman had a section where I thought it needed a crap load of percussion.
Ah.
You know, there was some percussion in the whole thing, but it's mainly that C section where it seemed like it should really go wild.
Yeah. Well, it's when the fact that you're saving the drum kit for a couple of places, and even I think sometimes when the drum kit is in there, it's like you've taken the kick and the snare and put them way over to one side and kind of made them sound far away. But then the toms are still kind of big and up front to the right or something. But it sounds like it's probably all the same kit that you just,
yeah,
as opposed to an overdub.
There are lots of percussion overdubs on it, but the drums come and go. I mean, I really like having things lay out. I've always tried to, Dinty Child is actually the guy who maybe more than anybody else taught me. He's our mandocellist. How effective it can be to, if you have a solo coming up, to lay out the verse before the solo. It just works. You know, there's so many great musicians that don't understand. It's a rare song where you just play all the way through.
Yeah, well, for a long time, even with a four-piece, I remember in college, like, telling prospective lead guitarists, like, pretend you're an oboe. The oboe does not play through the whole song.
With the Casuals or the Catbirds, it's not as big of a deal, you know, because, I mean, it's pretty stripped down anyway. But with the nine piece, it really becomes fun to arrange.
It's just even with a smaller band, like then you have so many fewer options for layering that you better use them.
Yeah.
The lead guitarist better have a pedal to be able to knock it, you know, at least three different levels of space filling and just know when to stop. And I guess, you know, we'll get to our second song where we actually have an example of that, of you doing the rock and roll thing. And even in that, how much actual lead guitar noodling is there? Not much. It really is very minor just to serve the song in a couple places.
I really try and stay away from noodling in general. I mean, I'm never happier than when I can find a place to stop playing. And if I can do that for a whole song, that's great. You know, to have a whole song with no guitar on it, that's great for me. The more unusual it is, like drums usually, you know, drums and bass in particular, tend to pretty much be everywhere. So if I can get rid of them for a little bit, then I'm totally happy.
With so many people, it seems like it varies from song to song how much autonomy you give them in terms of...
Yeah, sure does.
Like the third song we're going to listen to, Fluffy, like the horn stuff, if you had to write all that out, that would be just nightmarish.
Yeah.
That clearly had some, okay, now do something sort of like this, and then you hum something, and then like they kind of do crazy variations off that. Whereas in this, it all seems very much more controlled.
It's definitely one of my favorite parts of the Philharmonic is that we do some stuff that's completely written, where every note on every instrument is pretty much set. And then we do other stuff that's completely improvised, down to sometimes just coming up with a title live and calling it off. 1, 2, 3, 4. No key, no nothing. You know, there's a lot of improvisation and there's a lot of reading, both.
And for things like this, within the first minute of the song, there's this keyboard part that comes in that sort of sounds like vibes or sort of a glass of water, this little gooey thing. Things like that, would that be a you sitting with the player and kind of coming up with a good sound, or how does that arise mechanically?
Yeah, that was Cliff Spencer's idea, just that line.
Okay.
There's another, I think it's after the first loud section, when that first comes back, there's a lot of, I think it's accordion and organ.
Yeah, the accordion is crazily recorded. It's like, it sounds like you've got multiple mics on, like it's a stereo space in itself.
Yeah, I'm not aware of anything too crazy going on there. That that's one of those places where I don't know if we're laying out on the guitar there or not, because Steve Berkowitz, my friend who was helping me with this arrangement, really liked having that guitar figure in all the time. But live, I'm actually laying out on that lately and just having those chords happen. And that's been a lot of fun. You know, just having those textures change can really be powerful sometimes.
Yeah. So you've got, in fact, no beat. And then you introduce just enough percussion so that, oh no, we're actually still counting under this.
Yes.
Whereas I would have thought maybe it just stopped. Although mechanically, like the click goes on. You kind of have to decide how many measures this is going to be in some sensible way.
I really like how that arrangement came out. It was very collaborative, you know, and in the keyboard tracks in particular were things that didn't quite come out like I thought it was going to, but it was that whole arrangement just went all kinds of different places I never pictured it going. One of my favorite things to do musically, especially live, but anywhere really, is to surprise people. And when I get surprised myself, that's really, really fun. That's even better.
It's not terribly unusual for something to click up, you know, to go in a higher key. What seems more unusual is the fact that then you don't just bite the bullet and like play the next verse in that key, that it actually does this. Now we're going down, like that. Yeah. You actually hear on guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
Now
yeah.
We're back in the old key with that sort of announcement. It's a little purposefully ham-fisted in a fun way.
What can I tell you? I love a modulation. I also love when you can sort of seem like you're modulating. You know, when you do the bridge and it seems like it's going to be a modulation and then it comes back.
And then, yes, the role of the horns again in here. So you have the nice, is it flugelhorn or muted trumpet or something? The solo in the first part?
It wouldn't be flugelhorn, I don't think. That's trombone taking the lead in that section.
Okay. Yeah, and then the way that at the end of the song, when the horns come back, that you've got basically those same riffs, but scattered among, what, three or four different horns? How many do you have in the band? Is it just three?
We have three horns on that one. One of the things we did late in the mix, and this song was also on an album called Bocce and Bourbon, and one of the only really audible differences is that the whole band disappears for a horn section. There's a section that's just horns and vocals now. We also had sort of a, you know, that part that's sort of almost the talking part. There's a version of that that's sort of like where the guy sounds a little bit like Alastair Cook from Masterpiece Theater. Turns into this cultured guy, and I got talked out of using it. But it's around somewhere.
Well, that's exactly the kind of thing I was thinking, you know, in terms of if you do the same, who would know a shortcut through a cornfield? If you do that Pepperidge Farm guy voice every single time in performance, that would not be as fresh, but it's, you know, it's got the freshness that you just improvise that particular inflection on the spot. Obviously not the.
Well, the performance thing, we changed that around a good deal because it's a totally different guitar sound. It's like a slack key guitar that happens in that talking part. So I couldn't be on both electric and the slack key guitar on the same song live. So the live arrangement is still pretty different from that one.
Mm-hmm. Let's introduce the second one. We can always talk more about this if we want, but let's get the Crutch of Music by the Catbirds. So this is from 2012, at least released on the Catbirds Say Yeah, the full length that came out after the EP. So also David Greenberger writing lyrics here. So we won't talk too much about the lyrics, but very different approach. Deceptively, I kind of was thinking the should I stay or should I go? That kind of like riff heavy rock and roll thing. And like, it does introduce that, but then you've got enough subtle things in here, like the organ that comes in or the role that the piano plays, that it, at the end of the day, it seems like it's just as deliberative as Strongman. Obviously, many less elements going on.
It's pretty relentless arrangement wise. I mean, it just pounds away. And I don't believe there's an organ under it. There is a wonderful piano by Phil Clements, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, let's play it.
Doesn't jingle anymore. My hands were fast asleep at the wheel. There's a shiver with my name on it somewhere. Somebody scrub my deal. The deal is dead. Time to count up all my winnings. Was my great big golden shiny bean. But I've had it. You keep this stupid show this scene. Off I go.
standing up. I might be chewing and chomping at the bit. The offer was a little unfriendly, clumsy at best. And the worst is way too glum to really dwell. Love it to death. Just a little bit of moonlight, maybe 10 times still, and then a flash. That's the kind of light to grow on. Look at it, louder than cash. Off I go in a cloud of dust, waving high my crutch at the academy. Living like I know I can, wave my crutch while I'm sitting down. With money, I'm doing mine in the creek. You think they dream up everything, but they miss their sleep. I don't wanna watch the fat man swim laps in the pool. There's always someplace else to go when I feel less of a fool. Because I've got a handful of them, you can run them up your flagpole someday.
Yeah, those high noises are mandolin through a bunch of processors.
Yeah, so explain a little. It's just a mandocello is a big mandolin that's tuned differently. Is that the...
Yes, but I was wrong in saying mandocello. I love mandocello, and my friend Dinty Child, who's one of our founding members, plays a lot of mandocello with us. But on that particular song, it's mandolin through, I think, mainly just through an echoplex kind of a thing. Not literally an echoplex, but some sort of echoey pedal. I don't know if he's got other stuff on that or not.
Okay.
But that's the lead instrument in the break.
Well, and so one of the main shifts here in terms of you're doing different things on different days, and I see that these two bands often play on successive nights, that you're playing a whole different repertoire of material. That's a lot of lyrics to remember. I have a hard enough time remembering lyrics to one set of stuff.
I'm so ancient now that it's pretty hard for me to read stuff, you know, so I pretty much have to have it memorized if we're playing it on stage. They don't make pieces of paper large enough for me to put a whole lyric on it.
Well, and the other thing is you're switched to bass on this, which is another thing that I sympathize with, so that you can have, you know, it's a multiple singer-songwriter thing. Are you writing... Like, this one sounds like you came up with the riff on the bass as opposed to the guitar, just because there are extra little pickup notes in the bass.
Nope, that was a guitar riff. And, you know, I still play a lot of, like, I still do a lot of overdubs on guitars with the Catbirds, usually on the more complicated songs, not so much on the simple ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that seems to be the hardest thing, because I've seen you, again, play these live solo things. And, you know, there are a lot of tricky enough chords that unless you've got a jazz god playing with you who can just look at your hands and like, oh, that's fine, you know, I got that covered, then just teaching your own parts to somebody else.
Well, it's not jazz, really, but some of them do have a few chords. I've always been a little jazz challenged. I love listening to it, and I enjoy trying to play it, but I'm definitely a pop, rock and roll, folk kind of guy much more than a jazz guy. I wish I could say otherwise.
Sure, but there are enough tricks, which I guess is just a matter of if you write enough rock songs on guitar, unless you are dedicated to a certain kind of simplicity that, like, I don't care if I'm playing the same damn chords.
Yeah.
I want to keep my chordal vocabulary small. Unless you have that kind of ethic, then, you're going to be adding ninths and thirteenths and little turnarounds to make it interesting to play and make it distinctively that song as opposed to the other 100 things you've written.
I mean, that's one of the fun things about the Catbirds is that so much of our stuff is really primitive. And I love that. You know, you're talking about one of the hardest rocking guitar players and singers in the world there in Steve Wood. And I always just want him to sing everything. And he's great. And I'm trying to learn, again, not to overdub too much in that band especially. You know, I always frequently have too many ideas and just as frequently use too many of them.
I mean, it's great to have it work on both levels, that you can play it, this song maybe not. I don't know, do you do this one, the Crutch of Music solo at all? Or that'd be just too simple, like, we need a guitar solo in there or something.
I don't, in general, play solo because I've got so many great musicians to play with that it seems crazy to me to just go out solo. Well, you know, every now and then I'll get shoehorned into doing something. And then when I finally do it, it's sort of fun. But I mean, I did about a year or two of playing solo and didn't really care for it that much. I'm just not an interesting enough musician to really make that work. Plus, I like having somebody to talk to. It's a little more predictable what I'm going to do. You know, it's nice having some other cooks in the stew or whatever that, however that expression goes.
Well, at least having the two. The only Travis and Shook thing that I've seen is just on YouTube from what looks like just a year or two ago. Like you're still occasionally doing some shows together. Is that right? Or something in the last 5 years.
We'll do something every year. We'll do a show or two, or Steve will sit in with one of my bands or something like that. And he put out a solo album not long ago. Well, not an album. I think there's maybe 6 or 8 cuts on it called Dignity or Dignified or something like that. That's excellent. I mean, he's an amazing musician. And we're very, very close friends still. So we always end up doing something. Usually it'll be like, one set at a benefit, something like that.
It's just the chemistry of being used to talking to another person on stage as opposed to my comedy is talking to the audience. Like it seems it's a different skill in a way.
Yeah, it is to some extent. I mean, I love some of those. I mean, the Smothers Brothers are certainly a wonderful example of that. And also the Beatles of comedy to me is Bob and Ray. And that's all about conversation.
Well, and then you don't have to care how hostile the audience is exactly. Bouncing off them merely. Not that at this point, you're probably playing to very friendly crowds.
Oh, no. We still play a lot of bars, and a bar could be anything. I mean, a bar is such a fragile situation. You know, when you're playing in a small place, I mean, one table can totally turn the gig either way. If you get one horrible table, then you're screwed for the whole night. If you get one great table, then you got it made. You know, it's really that simple. And you just have no idea where it's going to go.
To push this back to the Crutch of Music, I mean, that seems like it's a fundamentally different project to have a recording that then you want to be intrinsically interesting for the whole thing. And so you're going to add these cool little offbeat piano things and just pay attention to the subtleties. But the song itself in a live setting, it doesn't need all that. It just having this power, this one riff basically, and this kind of talk singing thing that you're doing over it. It's not much of a melody through this song. Again, just like, you know, Should I Stay or Should I Go? I mean, it still works.
Yeah, it's got a release in the chorus, but other than that, it's pretty much of a bludgeon. It's like you said, it's all about the riff, and then there's a little release in the chorus, which is fun. And I appreciate the Clash reference. I love the Clash. I'm not that big of a fan of that particular song, but I'm a huge Clash fan.
Sure. Although, interestingly, with the talk singing, the way that you do it, because there's still definite pitches in different parts.
Yeah.
So it's not like Lou Reed doing it. That's one style.
Right.
But it's like, it's more like this is a song that, you know, one way of interpreting it, I'm sure this is not the case with this, but more like the parts that you end up talk singing in The Strongman, it sounds like, okay, there is a melody. I've sung this many times, and now I'm just kind of varying it up by talk singing it, by, you know, making it more animated, making it more like a theater piece by saying it. So it's kind of has the ghost of what the melody would have been if you were actually singing it.
I don't know what I was up to there. I mean, probably what I was up to is just trying to get some variation into it because the riff itself is so static.
Right. And it seemed, I mean, really in both of these, I was going to say the drums have control. It's more, I guess, less so in Strongman than in Fluffy that we're going to listen to. And in this one, it's the drums have so much control over the energy. The fact that you have that same riff, but then you have the snare on every beat. Like that's what changes up the intro from the first verse, besides the fact that you're singing something else.
all of the cuts that you've played and Fluffy, which I guess you're about to play, you know, all these feature amazing drum parts from Ricky Bates, our old drummer. Ricky's my guy from the Casuals, and, you know, we've worked together for years, and she's amazing.
Very hard pounding, very, very big sound.
Yeah, and I think, well, certainly Strongman has some drum overdubs, you know, electronic drum, you know, like keyboard drums that I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that Crutch of Music maybe has a drum overdub too, that he did. So they're both very drum oriented. And Fluffy, of course, is just nuts.
So the end of this song, the Crutch of Music. So what is the Birdie Boy stuff? Is that just, it's the Catbirds? It's singing about the name of the, like, that's not even in the written lyrics.
No. It had nothing to do with the name of the band. It wasn't written specifically as a Catbird song. I know I added that, and I actually was advocating calling the song Birdie Boy, but David was not into that. Yeah, I know I put that in there. I don't know what I was thinking, as so often is the case.
Okay, so there's an interesting example of you receive the lyrics in full from David, and and then this thing gets put on the end
Well, it's in there a couple of times, and I remember that being a source of wonder for David of going, you know, do we really need to hear as much of that as is in there? And I don't know what happened. I don't know if I took one out or what happened, but I remember there being some discussion about it.
It's only just twice at the end of the song that I heard, but it's got to end somehow. Yeah. It's a good way of doing it.
Well, yeah, that's what it comes down to. Yeah, it's got to end somehow.
Well, let's add Fluffy. So this is one just last night I said, okay, we have to put this on because it's hidden near the end of the 2003 album,
yeah,
Llama Rhymes, but you had highlighted it as the thing on your website, which is why, even though I'm sure I had listened through that album in full on Spotify, that it didn't jump out the first time. Or maybe I was just so weary by the end of it, because I got to say that these older Chandler Travis Philharmonic releases seem much less controlled in terms of, like I was saying, the Strongman and really quite a lot of, especially volume two here, you know, sounds like it could be solo stuff. It could be, you know, your smaller ensemble or just studio work. It doesn't necessarily sound like, again, the presentation of the 9-piece live band. But some of this older stuff, it does sound more like, you know, this is what we had worked up on stage and then we get it out there. So give us a little introduction to where the origin of Fluffy.
Well, I think the new album ends up being a little more disciplined and a little less experimental than its precursors in general. Maybe not the last one. Maybe not Chandler Travis Philharmonic Blows. I think both of those are relatively disciplined in contrast to the ones that came before that. And Fluffy is, I mean, Fluffy's always just been great fun. There's a nice video of that actually on our video page from when we played the Berklee Performing Arts Center. Great fun to play live. And another one where it changed a lot during the recording from how we do it live. The beginning is quite different and the bridge is, you know, I think the band pretty much falls out of the bridge at some point for a little while, which we don't do live. Always fun.
Well, it also sounds like there was also the Chandler Travis King of the World song with the group chanting and, you know, several other things like that that sound like they were written specifically as crowd pleasers. Not to say that, you know, I'm not trying to diminish the value of the song in itself, but like, this would go over very well. Like, this takes maximum advantage of the fact that we have all these people and they can yell in unison and they can.
Well, Chandler Travis King of the World, I think is, I mean, that's a fun tune to play live. That has no threat to anyone. Although it's a really strange thing to be when I get new guys in the band and I'm trying to, you know, teach them the old songs and stuff like that and telling the guy, okay, and here's what you sing next. You sing this instead of me, Chandler Travis King of the World. It's a little embarrassing. But that's all part of the fun, I reckon. And Fluffy, on the other hand, while it is a very good live song, that's got a lot of dissonance in it. So at some point, it became something that does go over well live, but it certainly wasn't written with that in mind.
Well, let's play it.
Your funeral.
Keep
So you got this huge, again, drum-driven thing, but very, you know, horns present in it right from the start. Describe the process of the horn arrangement. I could take a guess, but how do you get them to do that?
It starts with everybody being told to play a four-bar phrase, and they can make it up. It can be in any key. It doesn't matter what they play, but they have to play it four times.
Ah.
Both at the beginning, and they have to remember for the ending as well.
And they coordinate between each other, or they make it up on the spot and don't know what the person next to them is going to do?
Make it up on the spot and don't know what the person next to them is going to do. That's the goal. Now, some guys are more disciplined about that than others. But those are the directions.
I've definitely heard this method used before in some kind of big band jazz, but I'm not exactly sure. Like, is there a particular classic artist that you sort of had in mind? Like, okay, this is the kind of thing that they would do in terms of using horns in this way.
No, I don't think so. I mean, we're always mindful of Sun Ra in general, who has the same modus operandi that we do in that he does both meticulous arrangements and very free improvisations. So maybe somebody like him or Art Ensemble of Chicago or, you know, some of those people that play both arranged things and free improvisation.
Obviously, improvisation is not a rare thing in jazz, but it's the particular style of improvisation of, I don't care what key you're in, but we're going to play approximately the same rhythm or at least take up the same space so that it really, it's still coherent that it's this kind of call and response thing between the vocals and then the horns do something. And then actually what really makes the song is the harmony on the so fluffy. Again, what's going on there? You're kind of, is it that you're almost going up an octave, the main line, but it's only what, a major seventh or something. It's not quite hitting there. And then harmonizing on top of that.
Unlike a lot of my musicians, I'm not really trained. So it's difficult for me to talk about things sometimes. So I don't know technically what's happening.
Well, and again, it's still almost talk song. That's a, hey, you know, sort of a, it's something you can demonstrate rather.
I wouldn't have said that that was a talk song. That's most of the singing on that. Most of the melodies on that are pretty stable. There is a lot of improvising from the horns shoehorned into different. I mean, the breaks on it is, there's breaks on it as well that are live, are conducted. In other words, I try and sort of give them something visual to accompany is basically how that turns out. That's more understandable, I'm sure, live than it is on record where you can't see the visual part of it. We did do it that way in the studio, though. We did, you know, I was still doing my little dance and they were trying to do something that was appropriate to it.
Yeah, what still makes this seem like a crowd pleaser or something, you know, despite the dissonance being relatively straightforward, is because the main riffs, you've got this rockabilly sort of riff right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then you've got, when everything else drops out, it's sort of this R&B identifiably something familiar in some way. And then it's just the play between that house band familiar sort of thing with then this, again, the horns are doing something identifiably horn-like,
yeah.
but not the earth, wind, and fire arranged kind of thing you would expect.
I love how that one came out. It's got dissonance and improvisation, but it's tight in a way. And it also has that moment where everything just disappears in the bridge and the harp comes in. The whole bridge with all those chords is fun, too. You know, that whole song sort of comes across as a bit of an assassination attempt, and which is, it's really fun playing that live because there's no way anyone can expect that.
Yeah, how does that work visually? Was the harp itself just a studio thing, or do you actually have some sort of harp?
No. We didn't have an actual harp. It's just a keyboard. And that song in particular is full of great keyboard work from our original keyboardist, which is Keith Spring, who played with NRBQ for years, played saxophone, almost exclusively saxophone until about 20, 25 years ago when he completely gave up saxophone. And he always did play some keyboards. He wouldn't describe himself as a keyboard player. He's more of an arranger as well. It was interesting when he left the band, it was difficult to find the right keyboardist because Keith loved not playing when he shouldn't be playing. And a lot of times when he was playing, it would be like just a one hand kind of a one note thing, or, you know, it would be very judicious. You know, me being a rock and roll guy, when I first was looking for keyboard players, I was looking for, you know, a strong left hand and a guy who could pound. But it turns out that if you're trying to replace Keith, that you really want to stay away from somebody that just plays all the time. Keith's approach was such a non-keyboardy kind of thing. You know, he really used a lot of different sounds, and Fluffy's a good way to get to know Keith's playing in a way. Although a lot of his stuff is very pretty.
In this, he's really accompanying the horns in their dissonance, that he's in fact providing a little grounding for it in a way that that you can kind of fixate on that thing underlying the horns, as opposed to like, well, which of the horns is it, the trumpet that's loudest? It's not clear which horn to focus on. It's not like an arranged part where you've got the melody horn and then the identifiable backup or thickening parts. So that having the piano on there in these sections really seems to help. Yeah, just, you know, as somebody that really likes avant-garde jazz and can do those, or the history of jazz, you know, can go from Thelonious Monk to, I don't know what's much crazier than Thelonious Monk. Yeah. But
I'd love to write another song like that. I mean, but that's one of the things, you can't do something like that on purpose. It just seems like it's 3 minutes of vertigo. I mean, that song just completely, hopefully, in my mind anyway, it keeps you really off balance for a pretty extended time.
Well, and so I don't know if it's as effective for somebody who's not a huge George Carlin fan. But tell me about this giant, could he hear anything? He recorded this over the phone, and it's like almost a minute of stuff. It's a good 30 seconds, at least, 24 measures, and then dissolves into a mess.
Yes, we gave him exactly the time and seconds of what we needed from him in terms of improvisation. And the perverse part of that was that you're asking one of the country's great verbal people to do something that has no words at all, that's just complete gibberish. And I know he did that in his studio in California, and he sent it to me on the phone. And I always think about what this must have sounded like to his cleaning lady through the door. It certainly was a lot of fun to get those messages on the phone. And I think George probably really enjoyed that. One of the reasons we hit it off was because we're both record collector guys, and he liked all kinds of crazy stuff. So I'm sure he enjoyed that, and he sure did a fine, fine job.
Well, and again, there's something, knowing who he is and that this was literally phoned in, gives it a certain mystique, as opposed to, wow, now that we have the internet, can somebody please go through his stuff and send me the actual tape, and I'll, you know, make a nicer copy of it. Like,
There's an album called Tarnation and Alastair Sims, and you can hear the outtakes and also some conversation about the instructions and how long it is, and just him talking, a little bit of work talk. And that's a lot of fun, too. That's an interesting album in general. If you want to just get to the George parts, I think they start with Numbers. That album has like 45 tracks on it or something like that. Some of them quite short. And there's two or three George solo tracks just answering machine messages of having to do with Fluffy. Miss him a lot.
Well, to wrap us up here, let's just introduce the last song. So another Greenberger lyric line for By the Way. So it actually appears right after Strongman on the album, but quite different in some ways. You know, it's a very eclectic album, of course. But this is probably just one of the, I wouldn't be surprised if this had been a Catbird song, but it's got all the richness of arrangement that we've seen on Strongman, not people saying home, but in terms of just a sounding like a very expensive recording, let me put it that way.
Well, it's got that beautiful bowed bass part by John Clark and some nice keyboard work by both Cliff Spencer and Burke McKelvey. And we did try it in the Catbirds. I guess it could have been a Catbird song, but it's a little, it would have fit the Casuals better than it fit the Catbirds, because there's a certain sweetness to it that I didn't feel like it totally fit the Catbirds all that well. But I love the song, and both that song and Strongman in North America are on both of our last two albums. They're both on Wafing Kissy Head, and they were also on Bocce and Bourbon, because I love them, along with another one called Air Running Backwards, another Greenberger thing. But very proud of all those songs.
So Bocce and Bourbon was released in 2015, so that's sort of a compilation?
Yeah, it's stuff from all the different bands, the running thread being they're all Greenberger collaborations.
And then, so this is on Kissy Head Volume 2 and 1. Is it one was released as an EP, and now since you're releasing an actual CD that can accommodate both?
Yes.
Like, I found it actually helpful to actually then listen to it as Volume 2. So Volume 2 could be done with what sounds like an ending.
Right. That, and
and then
be.
Volume 1 is kind of this is much shorter and is much sillier. Like, yes. Just, I like the songs, but they're.
It's kind of a different thing. I'd sort of rather they weren't both on the same record, but I mean, it's sort of pointless to release a digital EP because, you know, we've never had much luck with that. So it was just a matter of convenience in case people wanted to get all that stuff in one place. And they all are from the same sessions, so it made some sense there. But yeah, I thought it was a different mood in Volume 1 than there is in Volume 2.
What's the next thing? Are there still a bunch of unrecorded songs that the band knows how to play, or is there a full 3-0 album?
In theory, the next thing that's coming out, and I'm pretty sure this will happen, is the next 3-0 album, which will be Wafing Kissy Head Volume 3.
Ah.
If we stick with the concept we have right now. And so that should come out late in the year, I would think.
And that band is just some of the members of the Philharmonic not showing up. Is that what that is? Are there actual different members?
It's quieter. It mostly doesn't have drums. Yes, it's Burke McKelvey, who plays just horns in the Philharmonic usually, but also plays keyboards with the trio, and our string bass player, John Clark, and myself, and Fred Boak, who's our my valet and singer and companion. And yeah, so we got that coming up. We're working on a musical, and I don't know if the musical will ever get produced, but David and I wrote a bunch of songs for a musical that will end up being an album, a Philharmonic album, I believe, if not actually a musical. And we're very excited about all that stuff. That stuff is coming out great. And then also, the Catbirds are due for another album, and we've been going great guns lately. We were just having really a lot of fun. We've got a new guitar player who's been terrific, a guy named Mark Usher. And there's talk of us working with a very famous British producer. So we're trying to put that together. I don't want to announce it yet because I don't want to queer the deal. But we're very excited about where that's going. So there's all kinds of stuff afoot. And then there's also, you know, I keep meaning to put out a Philharmonic live album someday, but the amount of material we have is so incredibly daunting that I don't know what's going to make that happen. It's all, you know, I'm never as interested in putting out live albums as I am in putting out, you know, recording stuff.
I thought the Bandcamp stuff, you released a whole bunch. So those are not mostly live stuff of the Philharmonic that you have in addition to the sort of standard albums. Okay, but these are older.
Some of those are, but they're from the Radio Ball series, which is a series we did in the year 2000 to celebrate the millennium, where we put out an album every 2 weeks. And some of those are live albums, although none of them are albums where you just hear a whole set or anything like that. They're all selected tracks from different shows and stuff like that, generally speaking. We did do one album. We had a record release party for our first album, Let's Have a Pancake. We played at Bickford's, which is like a International House of Pancakes place, a breakfast place. We played at noon, and we recorded that, and that was hilarious, and we had a ball doing that. So that's the exception to that rule, I believe.
Well, that's awesome. That's a lot on your plate. Can you comment on the business aspects of running this many things with this many players? I read it a blog post about one of your Catbirds thing that you were just trying to, you know, make enough to cover gas and didn't succeed in that case. Like, does this actually work as a small business, or is it just a calling and that's kind of what you expect from the people you play with?
It works as an adjunct to other businesses. Nobody but me relies exclusively on all of these bands. I mean, nobody but me is in all of these bands. And I think our business aspect can best be described as comical. I mean, show business is just silly anyway. And I guess my main comment would be help. It would be great to have some help.
Well, at least you're not waiting for anybody's permission.
Yes, exactly.
If you're going to really pursue your artistic calling and you're just, you know, nobody else is going to have to recognize that beforehand. And the fact that you have all these great players playing with you, and obviously that says a lot about the quality of your material and things like that. But just in terms of the day-to-day running of things that you're going to be out there doing this.
Well, you know, if you've booked yourself, then you know that that takes up the lion's share of your day. I mean, I spend 10% of the time I put in on things playing music, probably. I'd like it to be a much higher percentage, but I'm very lucky to get to spend the 10%.
All right. Well, thanks for spending a little time doing this. A lot of fun.
Take care.
By the way, I've got much to tell you, like the way I was dreaming. By the way, the special things you do, like the way you know my meaning. All the way, breakfast and the sky blue. By the way, time froze. Take away not one single moment. That's the way we chose. Tried to say how to slow the clock down. By the way, you were dreaming. On my way, nights turn into seconds. It's okay, we were sleeping. By the way, every star can find us on our way. So bright as the bay disappears behind us. Another day held tight. Breakfast and the sky blue. By the way, time froze as the bay disappears behind us. Another day held tight.
Wow. Thanks so much to Chandler for that insight into his many musical doings. Again, check out ChandlerTravis.com, where you can hear a lot of his music. And of course, given his breadth of work, there are whole units that we didn't even cover on here. The Chandler Travis Trio, his solo work, the more recent work by the Incredible Casuals, which sounds quite different than the 80s stuff. He even released an album of comedy songs credited to Lippy Black and Clappy. And with all the live releases, I count more than 70 albums on his store page. Crazy. Again, thanks very much for listening. Please check out nakedlyexaminedmusic.com for more episodes. Please subscribe on iTunes, or we're now on Stitcher. We have a Facebook page you can go like. I encourage you to share the episodes on that with all of your friends. Get the word out. There's a Spotify playlist you can follow that has all the songs that we cover on these episodes. You can follow me on Twitter at Mark Lintonmeyer. And of course, if you want to hear my music, check out marklint.com. We've got some great interviews coming up in future weeks. Next will be the amazing Jason Faulkner, a wonderful one-man band who used to play with Jellyfish and then the Grays in the 90s. Then Talia Zedek, best known for her work in the 90s band Come. Then Scott McCoy of the Young Fresh Fellows and the Minus Five, who played with REM for a long time. And I just recorded episode 50 with a songwriter named Anton Barbeau, who's very much in the Robin Hitchcock, Julian Cope, XTC vein. Just a hugely talented group of people. Please tune in again. But until then, keep on musicking. This is Mark Lintonmeyer signing off.